Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Welcome to the Horticulture Week podcast. I'm Rachel Forsyth, senior reporter at Hort Week, and on this week's podcast, I'm joined by Jack Potter, who is Ground Control's biodiversity manager. How are you, Jack?
Hello, yes, very well, thank you.
I always find it really interesting to hear how people made their way into the industry, because I feel like everyone has kind of a slightly different story. So what's yours? How did you come upon the industry?
So I sort of started off life on a hill farm in the Peak District, and used to do some sort of labouring type work for my father, and was immersed in the environment from the start, really. And that sort of piqued my interest in the natural world. And I wanted to break my way into the conservation sector, which was a difficult thing to do when you're starting from the bottom. So I sort of targeted the conservation organisations, which sort of actually paid the least out of all of them, because I thought you'd end up having less competition for higher responsibilities. So I ended up working for the RSPB, which at the time fit that criteria, as an apprentice, or an intern, they called it. My dad thought I was an absolute nutcase, you know, going to work for free when he was going to pay me minimum wage. But I've never looked back. Yeah, so I sort of worked my way up through the RSPB and found myself in Natural England after sort of working as a warden on the Dee estuaries up in Cheshire. That sort of introduced me to biodiversity, because in Natural England, everyone seemed to want to have biodiversity sort of taglined on their name. They wanted to have done something for net gain for biodiversity. And I wasn't an exception to that. So I sort of pursued opportunities internally within Natural England to sort of follow the biodiversity path as a sort of new and emerging area. And I ended up working in the national team on the biodiversity metric 3.0, the sort of technical aspect of that, and writing a lot of the guidance as well. So now I work for Ground Control, sort of in the private sector, effectively implementing the tools and guidance and policy which I helped influence, which is quite a rewarding position to be in.
So you're really seeing it from both sides of the coin, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. And I found it's invaluable to have had that experience on the other side of the fence, especially when you have potentially clients who aren't particularly happy with policies or tools that are available and how it affects them as a business. And having that really deep understanding of the metric and the guidance and the policy and all the things that have come before that, to actually put pressure on the right places or potentially interpret things differently, to be slightly more evidence-based and fit the client that's you know requesting.
Yeah, is there anything particular that you've learned about that metric since kind of, like you said, working on the ground, I suppose, at ground control on the other side of it?
Yeah, I think the main thing is that ground control are a very diverse company, and they, you know, their client base spans multiple sectors, and entering ground control as a biodiversity manager, I soon realized that actually the biodiversity metric and the guidance is very, very tailored to the development sector. And there are a lot of things within the metric and the guidance which almost precludes an entire sector which is looking to do, you know, to be called nature positive, or to tick the biodiversity boxes on their ESG accreditation for B Corp or others. So I think those elements which are specific to development creeping into the metric, although the metric was specifically created for it, I think is slightly short-sighted. So I'm hoping, you know, between now and the next sort of 5 years to try and influence that and try and make it more fit for purpose for anyone and everyone that's wanting to account for biodiversity impacts.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. Well, look forward to seeing how that develops over the next years potentially. So how long have you been at ground control as biodiversity manager, and what exactly does your job entail? Obviously, hopefully influencing the metric, but anything else?
So I've recently started at ground control. I've only been in post for about 3 months, and that's in response to ground control having a huge drive as part of their sort of core business model to really be pushing the biodiversity agenda. I mean, I think they've seen some of their clients requesting to be doing more for biodiversity on their sites, and understanding that. And ground control wanted someone who really understood the intricacies of metric as the sort of the main measuring tool, and how we can sort of focus that on our clients. So that's so I've only been working there for about 3 months, and sort of my day-to-day work involves I guess doing management plans, assessments, talking to clients about their drivers on. And some clients don't even know what their drivers are, to be honest. You know, they would like to do something good for the environment and give something back. Some of them don't even have land, and trying to understand how they can do something good for biodiversity and the environment with all the different constraints that each client gives is quite interesting.
Yeah, and it's so positive to hear that it's coming from the clients as much as it's coming from ground control, because I'm quite interested in how, as a grounds maintenance company or side of the business, you balance that kind of clients' desires, managing infrastructure, with kind of working for nature and working for biodiversity. How do you balance both of those?
Yeah, and it's an interesting conversation, and it's interesting every time we have the conversation with each client, because, you know, typically speaking, grounds maintenance of any given site will be, you know, mowing it more times a year than is good for biodiversity, cutting hedgerows more times a year than is good for biodiversity. And effectively for ground control, the more times we have to visit a site, the more money we get from contracting. So flipping that round and you know, maybe having a less intensive mowing regime, and less intensive cutting regime of hedgerows, it sounds counterintuitive from our perspective, but this is the direction of travel. This is the trend that clients are wanting to do, and if you don't move with the times, you'll end up being left behind. So you know, ground control are really, really forward thinking on this, and you know, in terms of income generation for ourselves and mitigating for those losses, it actually doesn't, you know, doesn't impact too much, because it ends up balancing out, because you know, doing the assessments for, you know, what's currently there and what you could do in the future, but also the monitoring, so people can measure and monitor and then report back to quantify the impacts that the change has had. So yeah, it's It's staying at the front of the market is effectively our main aim.
And is there a particular site or project that really stands out in your mind as an example of kind of working with a client to increase biodiversity?
Yeah, there's one that I've recently been working on with the Ministry of Justice with one of their sort of Crown Court sites, which is it's right next to an internationally important wildlife site and has quite a bit of green space on site as well. So trying to sort of figure out how they can quantify their biodiversity gain by changing their management regime, of which ground control is implementing, it was quite an interesting project to undertake. But also they've got their sort of probation requirements and how that actually fits into the management plan. Are there elements of increasing biodiversity which are locally relevant, and in this instance the international site next door was really important for deadwood invertebrates, and they've got woodland on site, so trying to incorporate as much deadwood and also bare ground was the other thing. So incorporating deadwood in terms of habitat piles, dead standing wood, and also creating intentional bare ground patches which could be colonized by invertebrates. It's an easy win. They will just simply overspill from the site next door into that area, and their activities that can be taken for probation, which is a big win.
So how do you teach your staff to kind of work within these remits as well? What does their work look like day to day?
So we're slowly and progressively trying to increase the knowledge of all staff within ground control, right from the top all the way, down to the people who are cutting the grass, and that involves training events, which I've been delivering quite a few of them, and some of them we've outsourced to specialist sort of surveyors, effectively experts in sort of the habitat classification systems, basically so people can be more aware of when something is important. So are you about to cut an area of grassland which is full of orchids and is potentially quite a valuable habitat, and it's being done at the wrong time? That's a trigger point, which means maybe we should get an ecologist to come and have a look at this and flag this with the landowners that they've got an important area of grassland. Whereas previously maybe that wouldn't have been recognised, all the way to the sort of contract managers who are representing ground control, to talk to the clients, and having those conversations, those initial conversations, just about what their ambitions are, whether they have an aspiration to, for example, make their site a more attractive place for people to come and work, to sort of lure them back from home working. After a sort of post-COVID world, all those sorts of conversations are what we're having so far.
Yeah, because we've touched a lot on those fantastic clients that really, really want to make these changes and become more biodiverse, but there is the other side where potentially clients are a little bit more reluctant. And is that the kind of conversations you're having with those clients, kind of showing them the other benefits that they can achieve?
Yeah, and that's really important to understand and make clients realise actually the social benefits. There's obviously financial benefits, and then there's just intrinsic benefits of improving wildlife. So there's all sorts of things which can be packaged up, and the scheme can be modified and tailored towards those needs as well. So it's a really important conversation to have and really understand the bespoke needs of each client to really drive that conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, it's been said that we're in a kind of biodiversity crisis. Do you agree?
Yeah, I mean, it's almost undeniable. There's been studies and reports done, basically identifying that the UK is one of the most nature depleted areas in the world, which is a pretty depressing place to be in, to be honest. There's all sorts of ecosystem models that have been done, which indicate that the UK is actually a tipping point of environmental collapse. So, this is a really critical time in history where every single scrap of valuable habitat or anything where biodiversity can live or corridors that connect them is absolutely critical to retain them, to enhance them, and also allow them to overspill into the wider environment, to create new areas. You know, we are in a real crisis right now, and we need to start talking about it more and continue to talk about it.
Yeah, and obviously as an industry, we can do our part for sure. Do you think we're a little bit limited by the government as well? Do you think they understand to enough extent how important biodiversity is and how important our industry is as well in preserving biodiversity and fighting climate change?
I think up until last week, I would have said, yes, I think they do understand. But in light of last week's bill, which effectively proposes to expire our most our strongest and most important environmental legislation, I would have said yes. But in light of that, I'm probably going to have to say that it's uncertain right now. The Environment Act, which is driven biodiversity net gain specifically in the development sector, and is also driving the what's called the local nature recovery strategies, where each individual area will sort of map out where their existing valuable areas are and where there's opportunities for expansion and connectivity. That's a step change in what we've seen previously, and is very welcomed by the sector. So, you know, never before have we had a blank canvas of you know, someone's farm who's looking to sort of diversify from intensive agriculture into creating a nature reserve and using that to offset development, for example. But yeah, in light of the government's announcement last week, you know, removing those protections and potentially lessening them of our essentially core sites, which are our most valuable, they're internationally important, is worrying to say the least.
It just seems so backwards and it can be so frustrating as an industry. Do you have any advice for what, you know, businesses, individuals can do, whether they're working on a private garden, commercial sites, anywhere really?
Yeah, I mean, there is a direction of travel you know, there's an increased need for businesses to be at least caring or quantifying and doing the right thing for biodiversity and the environment. Carbon and climate is obviously top of the agenda for many organisations at the moment, and how to quantify that and minimise their impacts and decarbonise their organisations. But yeah, biodiversity is sort of the next thing which is coming down the road. And there's a lot of proactive organisations which are, you know, they can do it. It potentially doesn't cost them any more money and it makes them look really good. So, you know, why wouldn't you do it? So, yeah, there's a lot of things going on at the moment, including there's a sort of UN Task Force for Nature-Related Financial Disclosures, which has been set up. I believe it was last year it was set up. And they're really pushing this agenda, you know, in the non-development sectors, on how they can quantify their risks, their dependencies on nature, but also the opportunities that each company has to enhance biodiversity. So that's a real change in what we've previously seen. And it's a lot more complicated than carbon, but it just brings a huge opportunity for people to actually integrate how biodiversity and nature actually underpins our economy and some businesses and makes them realise that. Mm-hmm. And then also just showing people what opportunities they have at potentially no cost to do for the environment. So it's a great change and it's very welcomed. And you know, I think it's going to be a very interesting space to be in over the next sort of 5 years or so.
Yeah, that sounds really positive. Because obviously ground control became carbon neutral in 2020 and now you're working towards net zero. For you guys, how does biodiversity play into that goal?
Yeah, so I mean, we're well on target to meet the net zero by 2050. We're sort of integrating biodiversity into everything we do, and you know, our carbon ambitions are no exception to that. A few years ago, we implemented a woodland creation scheme of about 9 hectares in Essex, where Ground Control's headquarters is, called Little Cowbridge Wood. The details can be found on our website. And effectively, that was sort of a biodiversity and carbon-led project to partly reconnect the landscape between other parcels of woodland, but also to quantify the carbon benefits, of which takes some time to mature, so they won't be able to be counted towards our carbon targets for another 15 years or so. But it's a step in the right direction, and it's quantifying the benefits of two different credit systems, effectively.
Brilliant. So, yeah, showing how they can really work together. Do you have any top tips for biodiverse-friendly maintenance? If someone's working in a private garden or a commercial site, is there anything they can be doing?
I mean, a lot of these sites are hedgerows and grasslands, effectively, you know, whether it's a garden or a commercial site. And I think cutting less often is always going to be a good thing to do, especially in, you know, you'll have probably heard of No Mow May, and some people even extend that to No Mow June.
Yes.
So, you know, just in that key period of flowering time, if you just don't mow, or if you can't not mow all of it, just don't mow some of it, as long as there's some areas which are left long. Because when we talk about biodiversity, it's the diversity of species, and you're going to have more diversity of species the more habitats and structure of habitats you have. So where you get a lot of species is where you have those interfaces between different habitat types. So short grassland is probably not going to support a huge amount, but the interface between short grassland and long grassland will actually probably support quite a lot.
Right.
And then that interface between long grassland and a hedgerow, for example, or some trees, would actually provide another niche. So having that structural diversity, and potentially not cutting as frequently in the crucial period during sort of spring, summer, is probably the best thing that anyone can do.
Right. Well, from biodiverse havens to desert islands, my final question for you is just a bit of fun. What plant would you take to a desert island?
I think I would take bird's foot trefoil, which is otherwise known as eggs and bacon.
Okay.
It's a sort of indicator. It's an indicator species that sort of shows you that might be some interesting grassland here. It's a fairly diverse species which can sort of cope with lots of different types of soils and hydrologies. So, and it also flowers, you know, prolifically throughout the year. During the sort of spring, summer, autumn period, the flowers just keep going and they keep coming. So it's a great pollinator. It's a great indicator of something that's interesting. It doesn't grow really big and shaggy. It's, you know, it's fairly, you know, neat. So yeah, I think I'd take that with me.
Sounds brilliant. It sounds like it doesn't grow eggs, though, unfortunately.
No.
Well, thank you so much, Jack, for joining us. That's been really interesting. I think you've given some real practical advice there, and you sound quite positive about the future. There's definitely still so much we can do to save our biodiverse havens.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the most important thing is for people to keep talking about it, because as long as the public care, which they currently do, the more that the politicians will care and the legislation will follow. So, you know, I've heard in the past people saying that, you know, doing things in your own garden isn't going to do anything for nature recovery in the UK, from sort of well-known Guardian journalists, which, you know, immensely frustrates me, because that's empowering the people to do their bit. And it does make a difference. You know, people can have more diversity of life in their gardens if they do the right things and use native species. But the most important thing for me is that it empowers them to have a voice, and it inspires them to care. So if there's anything that anyone takes away from this, is just carry on caring and carry on talking about it, and hopefully everything will carry on in the current direction of travel that it is.
100%. And those small private gardens can come together to create a really great green corridor. So every green space is valuable. Well, huge thank you again, Jack. I'm Rachel Forsyth, and this has been the Horticulture Week podcast. Make sure you never miss one. Subscribe or follow Horticulture Week podcast via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or your preferred podcast platform. If you are interested in producing a podcast with Hort Week, email us at hortweek@haymarket.com. Huge thank you again, Jack, and goodbye for now.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.